It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Rico Bronya, the New York Mets absolutely suck. In a season of rock bottoms, in a season of pathetic offensive performances, followed by pathetic offensive performances, I think that this series against the Miami Marlins and this Memorial Day Sunday against the Marlins may have been rock bottom. Except the problem with rock bottom means it can't get any worse. And it very well can get worse. It's almost expected to get worse. Now, before I get into this series and the Sunday game, I do want to remind anybody who may have missed it. We have an episode, episode 697 of the Rico Bronya, in which we discussed the pathetic loss on Friday night by a final score of 2-1. And then the equally pathetic loss on Saturday afternoon / evening, 4-1. So if you want to hear in-depth breakdowns on the pathetic offensive performance of Friday and Saturday, you can go back to episode 697. What we'll do on today's Rico is we will talk about the finale of this series. We will hand out the illustrious awards, the Rico I'm the Man Right Now Star of the Series and the Net Negative. We'll read a ton of your emails. We'll look ahead to Cincinnati. We're on to Cincinnati. But my God, this was bad. And in a season of a lot of badness, like bad teams go on good stretches. Bad teams will play decent baseball. And over the last few weeks, while the Mets haven't really played well at all, they've won games. They've managed to put at least a couple of W's up there and cut into the huge deficit they created from their 12-game losing streak. And you look at the way they beat the Yankees, and you look at the way they won that series against a quality opponent and the miracle comeback of Sunday afternoon, it is amazing to me, though it shouldn't be amazing, that we are sitting here exactly a week later from all the excitement of beating the Yankees 2 out of 3 and winning that Sunday game the way they did. It is insanity to me that we're sitting here a week later after playing division rivals who are not that good in the Washington Nationals and the Miami Marlins, and the Mets somehow put together a 2-5 road trip. And not only a 2-5 road trip, they managed to go to Miami and combine for 11 hits in 3 games and 2 runs. How is that possible? I know the lineup sucks. I know the lineup sucked. I know Juan Soto had an illness. Don't we all? I think we all have an illness. It's called Metsitis. It's called watching this garbage team. But to go up against a Miami team that has a team ERA in the fours, whose pitching is not exactly going to remind you of the 65 Dodgers, to go up against that team and score 2 runs over 3 games. And if we're being fair, one of the 2 runs they scored was an absolute garbage run that they scored in the 9th inning of a game that they were losing 4-0 with 2 outs and nobody on. So even one of the 2 measly runs that they scored was like a meaningless Fugazi rally run. For this offense to actually do that, first of all, I am retiring the phrase LD, limp dick, as it's been called. Because when I used that phrase, when I used it last year, it was to describe a competent offense that, for whatever reason, would go limp for periods of time. This is not a competent offense. It's not. From top to bottom, it's bad. It's bad all the way around. So I know we have gone through different phrases that we can use, but it ain't LD. It just stinks. And for all of us, and there's a few of us, who consumed all, let's say it combined out to be about 8.5 hours of baseball over the weekend, we got to ask ourselves, what are we doing? What are we doing watching this team? I say that right as I begin a 1-hour podcast breaking down the team and then reminding you that, oh, don't worry, I'll be here 2 days from now for another Rico, and we will stick with you throughout this season. So I know exactly what we're doing. We're just deranged Met fans. But this on every level, and there's been a lot of bad throughout this season. Like when I think of the sweep at the hands of the Colorado Rockies and the doubleheader sweep from that Sunday, that's really bad. When you think of the annihilation in LA and in Chicago, really bad. But in a lot of ways, this three-game series against the Marlins is probably worse, only because it was that final nail. As the Mets are making this itsy-bitsy run to cut into the deficit they created, they go on this road trip with a chance to do some kind of more damage. I mean, they go into this road trip six games under 500, and the thought is, can you get this to five games under 500 or four games under 500? Obviously, it was a seven-game road trip, so based on the math, I guess if you went 4-3, you cut it to five. And if you go 5-2, you cut it to three. And we're slowly starting to see how this team could at least save what feels like a lost season. And they go backwards. Against Washington and Miami, they go backwards. And you really want to feel horrible about this team, more so than we already do? Think about the games they won. They were lucky. They were lucky as hell with the way they won on Monday night to begin this road trip with that crazy extra inning victory. They were lucky. The finale of the four-game series against the Nationals, in which the offense was extra limpy, they were lucky to win that game. And those were the two wins they got on this seven-game trip against the Nationals and the Marlins. And you probably hear it in my voice, and you could certainly hear it in the voices of Gary Cohn and Ron Darling. There is a resignation now amongst a lot of us. It doesn't mean you aren't mad. It doesn't mean you aren't frustrated. But you're almost accepting that this is who we are. This is us, as the TV show said. This is us. They're not a good team. And so as you go through a season of watching a bad team that you know is bad, and we all come to that point differently, you know, we all kind of arrive to that moment at a different place. A couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine said, "Evan, you sound like Beningo, how negative you are with this team." And I politely said, "I don't know what you're watching, but this is a bad team." I wonder, with someone like that, do they now realize that they're a bad team? Or does it happen all at a different moment? Maybe it was Miami. Maybe they're not there yet. Maybe it's going to take a week from now to get to the point of they're not good. And there's a lot of reasons they're not good. Some of it's bad luck. Francisco Lindor being out, yes, it's a part of it. I'm not saying it isn't a part of it. And I will accept the Lindor injury as one of the real reasons that has caused this season to go awry, even though it wasn't exactly going well before he got hurt. But you know what I won't accept? I will not accept hearing about Luis Robert Jr. I won't. And I say this as a Robert Jr. supporter. I will not accept hearing about Jorge Polanco. I won't. Because those are guys that were brought in with a full understanding that they have an injury history. You cannot bitch about injuries after bringing guys in who have injury histories. That's hypocritical. Can't do it. But does this team miss Francisco Lindor? Of course it does. But am I naive to think that this would be completely different if Lindor was healthy? It wouldn't be that different. They'd win a few more games, sure. If Juan Soto played in this game, maybe they win this game. Maybe Juan Soto comes up instead of, I'm trying to think, who replaced him in the lineup? MJ Melendez. That was the guy who essentially replaced Juan Soto in the lineup. Melendez, believe it or not, got on base a bunch of times in this game. So maybe it wouldn't have been that different. He got on base three times in this game. But maybe Juan Soto, who was locked in, hits two solo home runs, and the Mets are up 2-0 going into the ninth inning. And instead of basically intentionally walking two guys in a row, Devin Williams gets through a leadoff double like he did on Thursday. Who knows? The point is, yes, they're affected by not having Francisco Lindor. They're affected by not having Juan Soto in their lineup. But any good functioning team finds a way to overcome it. At least if you are a good team, you overcome it. This is not a good team. And I welcome you, for those loyal, kind of positive Met fans, I welcome you to the train of, oh yeah, this team sucks. If it took Memorial Day Sunday against the Marlins, if it took three games against Miami, I welcome you aboard. And I remind you about this train of knowing the Mets suck. We all hope we're wrong. Like, before I dive into every detail, I am hoping that out of absolute nowhere, we're slapped across the face and they go have a homestand against Cincinnati and Miami where they go 6-0. Now, there's no chance of that happening, but I hope it does. Now, with that said, let's get into this game. And I'll start with the offense. I'll get to the bullpen usage. I'll get to Christian Scott. I'll get to how the ninth inning was managed. But unlike Saturday's game, where the Mets had no opportunities, the Mets had very few opportunities to score runs. I was going through their lack of runner in scoring position chances until the very end. They had no chances. They weren't getting traffic on the bases. Unlike Saturday and even Friday, they went 0-for-0 with runners in scoring position. On Saturday, they didn't get their first runner in scoring position until Mark Vientos' two-out double in the ninth inning. Let that sink in. So the Mets went essentially two games against the Marlins without ever even getting a real scoring opportunity. In Sunday's game against the Marlins, they get the base hit by A.J. Ewing and the stolen base, which I appreciated that A.J. Ewing was aggressive, because A.J. Ewing has had his issues being thrown out trying to steal bases. And you don't want to lose that aggressiveness. A part of why A.J. Ewing is in the major leagues, a part of why there's faith and hope that he can turn into an impact major leaguer, is his ability to steal bases. If this is a guy who at some point in his major league career can hit for a high average, get on base, and then proceed to steal 50 bases, that'd be awesome. So I'm glad he didn't lose his aggressiveness. But in the first inning, runner on second, two outs, Vientos flies out to center field. I'm thinking, is that going to be their only scoring opportunity? But it shouldn't be. They're facing Tyler Phillips, who, while he isn't technically an opener, isn't going to go deep into the game. You're going to get to face the real meat of the Florida Marlins, Miami Marlins bullpen. Then in the second inning, I always love these. You get a gift. You get a defensive miscue gift. Marcus Semien, who is just atrocious, hits a weak ground ball to third base, and Javier Sanoa makes a terrible throw. And Marcus Semien goes to second. And so here we go. Runner on second, one out, two cracks at the apple. MJ Melendez strikes out. What a shock, considering he's been awful over the last few weeks. Tyrone Taylor works a walk, which I wouldn't have even faced Tyrone Taylor if I'm the Marlins, if I'm Clayton McCullough, because the on-deck hitter is the pitcher's spot, also known as Hayden Senger. Now, I was stunned that Hayden Senger gave one a ride, and off the bat, I thought had a chance to possibly be over the right fielder Casey's head for a double, but instead it gets run down by Casey. Inning is over. So now we're two innings into this game. The Mets have had three at-bats with runners in scoring position. They're 0-for-3. So far different from Saturday and Friday, but here we go. The Met offense getting opportunities and not coming through. In the fourth inning, they get a one-out hit by Brett Beatty, a nice walk by MJ Melendez. It gets Phillips out of the game. It sets up 2-on, 2-out for Tyrone Taylor, and he flies out to left field. So there's your fourth opportunity with runners in scoring position. But we're not done yet. Fifth inning, two-out rally, a little two-out magic. Bo Bichette, welcome to the series, base hit. A.J. Ewing behind in the count, base hit to right field. Quality day by A.J. Ewing. Two on, two out. Mark Vientos grounds out. Mark Vientos, outside of his double at the end of game two, a very quiet series, especially in this game when he comes up with multiple opportunities. Sixth inning, leadoff walk to Brett Beatty. Okay, we're cooking, we're in business. What does that stiff Marcus Semien do? Bounces into a double play. So the traffic was there. Then you get to the seventh inning, one out walk to Carson Bench, steals second base. Great to see. Two opportunities now with a runner on second and less than two outs. Bo Bichette flies out the center. A.J. Ewing strikes out. We are now at 0-for-7 with runners in scoring position if you are scoring at home. I was, so I have it ready for you. And then in the ninth inning, You get the leadoff hit by MJ Melendez. You get the Nick Morabito caught stealing. Nick Morabito has had a very tough start to his career. I laugh because it's not the end of the world. It's early in his career. He's got a lot of time to prove himself. But between not catching a baseball that he got to, which essentially turned that game haywire earlier in the week against the Nationals, he strikes out every at-bat, caught stealing in a big spot in the ninth inning. And even after that, you get the two-out walk by Luis Torrens, goes to second on a wild pitch, and here's Carson Benj, who needs to understand that there are certain moments where it's okay to challenge. Carson Benj missed a chance to challenge on Friday. We talked about it on our last episode of the Rico. It turned out not to matter because he drew a walk anyway. The 1-2 pitch in the ninth inning was borderline enough where you have to challenge it. And I went to the MLB Game Day app just to see. I think it would have been upheld, but it was going to be very close. And so before we even get to what happened in the ninth and what the Met pitching did, nine innings, five hits, zero runs, 0 for 8 with runners in scoring position. And those numbers were not against Max Meyer, who spins the ball well. It wasn't against Yuri Perez, who throws 99. It was against the entirety of the Marlins bullpen. Tyler Phillips, Calvin Fauché, John King, Anthony Bender, Michael Peterson, and Pete Fairbanks in his 8.5 ERA. Those are the guys that put that pitching line together. So no more, let's tip our cap. Hey, Max Meyer really knows how to spin them. No. You got shut down with 8 runner and scoring position opportunities by that. And it's unacceptable. And so you put Christian Scott and every other reliever that came in a situation in which one tiny mistake will cost you. I thought Christian Scott continues to be impressive. He was not dominant in this game. I thought what was impressive about Scott in this game was his ability to make the big pitch. Gives up a one-out double in the first inning, gets through it. Loads up the bases in the third inning, control, major issue. Bases loaded, one out, gets a huge strike out of Owen Casey, gets Stowers to ground out. Two on, one out in the fourth inning, gets a big strikeout and a flyout, and pitches into the sixth inning. Impressive. Look, half the battle is you're going to put guys on base. Are you able to make the big pitch to get out of it? And Christian Scott left it out there, man. He goes into the sixth inning, doesn't give up a run. He did everything he could. He wasn't dominant. He wasn't perfect, but he was good enough. And if the Mets had any semblance of an offense, he would have had his first major league win on Sunday afternoon against the Miami Marlins. Waskar Brazoban was able to make the big pitch to get through the sixth inning. Brooks Raley was shaky as all hell and, quite frankly, was lucky that the Mets didn't just lose that game in the seventh. Then he gives up that base hit to Xavier Edwards, and A.J. Ewing makes the great throw home. The defense of A.J. Ewing, especially the arm strength after we watched Luis Robert Jr. man center field earlier this season, he's not giving the center field job back. A.J. Ewing is the guy. I don't know what he's ever going to be offensively, but right now he plays very sturdy defense. He still has the confidence to try to swipe a bag. He's got to cut down on the strikeouts, which is, I think a lot of it is just being really conservative and taking a lot of pitches that he shouldn't take. But A.J. Ewing is clearly going to get this opportunity to play every single day. And his defense in the seventh inning kept the tide. He kept him in the game. He did everything he could. And even after Raley put the 3 straight guys on, he gets the big out of Kyle Stowers to at least get to the seventh inning. Great inning by Luke Weaver in the eighth. And now let's get to the ninth with Devin Williams. The mistake that Devin Williams made was the double to Christopher Morel. He got ahead of him, gives up a rip line drive in a left field, very different than what happened Thursday, where it was bad luck on a blooper. And now you put yourself in a spot where if you're Devin Williams, where you got to be perfect. You need strikeouts if you're going to get through this inning, especially after Sanoa laid down the bunt perfectly and there's a runner on third. I agreed with Gary Cohen Gary was very adamant about not facing Hicks and Xavier Edwards and loading up the bases for Heriberto Hernandez, who had come in earlier pinch hitting for Casey against Raley in the seventh inning. He was right. Now, we got there in a very shaky way because Mendy allowed Devin Williams to face Liam Hicks and fell behind him, got it to 3-2, and then tried to, I think it was a fastball up that he tried to elevate, and it was way high, and Hicks drew the walk. And then at that point, after the strategy meeting, they walked Xavier Edwards. So Gary Cohen, who was pushing that from the moment, really the bunt was laid down by Sanoa, I agreed with him. It is not a good spot to be in when it's a tie game and the winning run's on third base and there's less than two outs, but you're choosing the hitters. You're looking at who's coming up, and you're saying, okay, we've got Liam Hicks, who's got 44 RBIs this season, hit two home runs the day earlier. You've got Xavier Edwards, who's hitting over 300. I'm not facing either of these guys. So I thought it was a no-brainer, honestly, to walk both of those guys. But then you got to execute. That's what it comes down to. Then if you're Devin Williams in a bases-loaded one-out spot, you know you can't fall behind. Obviously, you got nowhere to put anybody. You can't have hard contact unless it's right at somebody in the infield. The infield's in, so even a ground ball, like, it can easily sneak past the drawn-in infield. You can't really play back because turning two is a long shot. It's just the game was lost, besides the offense, by Devin Williams giving up the leadoff double. Because now you need perfection. And it made it worse that it was a grand slam, no doubt. Like, Heriberto Hernandez, it's a fly ball to center field. The Mets lose 1-0. It's the same loss. It's the same patheticness. But, you know, you tack on a game-winning grand slam by a non-household name. It just adds to the embarrassment. It adds to LOL Mets. It adds to, what did Joe Davis say? Oh, the Mets. Oh, the Mets. I mean, right now, he's right. The Mets. That's what we are. Let's read some of your emails. That's always good to hear what the people are thinking in the midst of this losing streak and where this season is going. You could always email us, thericob@gmail.com, thericob@gmail.com. Steven writes, hey, Evan, if the Mets played a 162-game season against the Marlins in Miami, what do you think their record would be? I think 40-122. And unfortunately, this probably rings true for the last decade plus. Certainly feels that way, and certainly on the heels of what happened last year and the way the season ended. Can't argue that. Jim writes, flaccidity. Love the Rico, Evan. Thanks for letting me commiserate with you and all the other disgruntled Met fans. However, I'm getting tired of all the discussions about the LD offense without ever mentioning the waste of a Mets uniform occupant by the name of Troy Snitker. These guys can't hit water if they fell off the boat. Time for him to depart. They changed coaches. They changed their hitting coach, and their approach is as bad, if not worse, than it was last year. You know, we can sit here and go through the lineup and how the guys aren't good enough, but some of the guessing, some of the takes, it really just doesn't make any sense. And it will fall at the feet of a guy like Troy Snitker. Michael O wrote this email 5 minutes into the game. Two batters in, we will be no hit. Well, they weren't no hit, but two batters in, the third batter did get a hit. So I guess you broke up the no hitter. Michael C. writes, big fan, please allow me this space to rant for a second. Of course, this is what the Rico is these days, a rant. We can't hit fastballs and chase breaking balls. We won't walk. We have little power. Our approach collectively at the plate sucks due to lack of discipline and situational awareness. We have average team speed and don't really steal bases with regularity. We don't walk and, conversely, walk too many batters. Our defense is collectively average to below average. Our starters rarely go more than five, and our bullpen is often gassed because of this. We don't have a bona fide ace. We're not healthy, and we can't stay healthy. Our manager isn't a good in-game manager. Our players are overpaid. Our general manager doesn't adapt his overly analytic mindset and manages like we're a small market club. We lack real leadership. Our clubhouse culture, by all accounts, is pretty bleak. There's not much to be super jazzed about in the farm system, especially on the pitching side. But other than that, everything's great. Michael C., 34-year-old lifetime fan, suffering with these lifeless bunch of losers. Well, the farm system has to excite you. Half of it's already here. Jonah Tong was impressive. Jack Weninger may be here at some point. Ryan Clifford had a good Sunday. He may be here at some point. Steve from Lawrence writes, at this 0-0 game with my three granddaughters, aged 10, 9, and 6, it's the eighth inning. I have to agree with them. I'm bored. Yeah, this is a bad one. I like pitcher's duels, but some games are not pitcher's duels. They're just inept offenses. Nick writes, Gary and Ron have a calm resolve. They are calling the game without frustration, meaning they have capitulated and are expecting no offensive output. They have seen the death of the season, and they are now just going through the motions. It feels like an August 2012 game. I agree with that. I don't know if people could say that about the Rico as well, that we're just going through the motions, that my anger may not sound the same as 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or the height of the 12-game losing streak, because I think we've all accepted that they're a bad team. I don't know how you haven't. I don't know what you'd be watching that would tell you differently. And certainly Gary Cohn has seen a lot of Met baseball over the years. He knows what he's seeing. Mark writes, I live in Tennessee, and I have to pay $140 per year plus extra when for the Braves and Red Series blackouts to watch the New York Mets. That is the only reason I'm still wasting 2 to 3 hours daily on this year's team. I never thought I'd be thankful for the pitch clock, but it does keep my misery down to a minimum. That is a great point, Mark. I have sat through many bad Met seasons. This obviously is going to be among them. And a lot of those games would be 3.5 hours. A lot of those games would be long. And luckily, because of the pitch clock, at least the misery is shorter. Look at Saturday's game. Saturday's game was 2 hours and 18 minutes. Think about that. 2 hours and 18 minutes. In 2012, how many games were 2 hours and 18 minutes? Kyle writes, Evan and Hoff, it's the top of the ninth inning right now. And Nick Morabito just got thrown out by a perfect throw, and Luis Torrens was down 0-2 and found a way to get a walk. That walk was massive. This means that if the game goes extras, Torrens will not be the Manfred man, and Benj will, since he just struck out looking. I would have challenged there, but he's terrified to do that being a rookie, and with how bad the Mets are at challenging, I'm sure he told himself he's not even going to bother. Regardless, I hope this game goes into extras and Benj being at second wins us the game. Let's hope that's the case. I thought the same thing. I get your sentiment, Kyle, because when Torrens drew the walk, I never thought he would score. Though the wild pitch gave me kind of hope that Benj had a chance to keep the streak going of every time he drives a run in, the Mets win. But I agree with you. I thought the best part of that walk was the idea that if the game went to the 10th inning, it's Benj on second base instead of Luis Torrens. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way because Devin Williams, who has pitched so well, did not pitch well. Leadoff double did him in. You know, when the Mets win a game, and hopefully they'll win another soon, you can celebrate your highlights with Mio Sparkling Sake, a true crowd pleaser, light, bubbly, and easy to enjoy. Whether you're over at Citi Field or your favorite spot, you could ask for Mio Sparkling Sake by name, a new tradition served chilled, imported from Japan, the official sake of Rico Brogna. Enjoy responsibly. I think the net negative will feature so many great candidates, while the Rico I'm the Man right now star of the series is always a challenge when you get swept. But believe it or not, I have a few candidates for the I'm the Man right now. We've got Freddy Peralta, who did go 7 innings. He allowed 4 runs, but hey, 5-inning Freddie went 7. I've got Christian Scott, who did pitch into the 6th inning, and I thought showed a lot of poise fighting his way in and out of trouble. I think Christian Scott deserves honorable mention. And then I think you've got Jonah Tong, because Jonah Tong, in a 2-1 game, after struggling in the minor leagues and struggling in the major leagues last year, comes in the sixth inning of a one-run game, faces nine batters, gets eight of them out, strikes out two. Marvelous work by Jonah Tung. And those are your only options. Because I would forbid anybody from suggesting that an offensive player could be the Rico I'm the man right now star of the series in a series where they scored two runs. A.J. Ewing did have three hits in this series, which I think led the team. He did steal a base, though he was caught twice, and he made a really good defensive play. So I guess he's the one position player that maybe you hesitantly give honorable mention to. But it's really those pitchers. Those are the choices to me. It's Christian Scott, it's Jonah Tung, and it's Freddie Peralta. I'm going to try to screw around with my computer to see if I can hear Pete Hoffman. But since I know the people can, Hoff, state your case. I know it's a tough case to make because they just got swept by the Marlins. But we are very loyal to our Rico, I'm the man right now, star of the series. State the case in your mind who you think should be the man right now, as I will try to figure out if I can actually hear you. Go ahead.
I don't know who the hell you can talk. I mean, Jonah Tung is a good choice.
Yes.
Just because of the situation he was in. Christian Scott pitched really well. I just don't like anybody. I mean, I know we have to because that's what we do. I will lean towards – I mean, Soto did hit a home run, right?
Yeah, I guess we can give Soto a little bit of credit. I'm trying to ignore him. He was 2-for-3 in the opener with a solo home run, their only run, and then he was 0-for-3 with a walk in game two. That's not enough. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I'm trying. Because it's just tough, dude. Like, I will – Freddie Peralta can go to hell for all I care. No offense. Like, I mean, you can't be an ace of a staff, go seven innings and give him four runs and us be like, oh, well, he went seven innings deep. Can't do that. So I think it's between Tong or Scott. I know Manaea did okay, but I think it's Tong or Scott.
I think it's Jonah Tong. I think that Jonah Tong deserves a lot of credit because he comes into a game in which it's 2-1. So it's even worse than Christian Scott pitching in a 0-0 game. You're already down by a run, and you know how bad this offense is. And I think what elevates Tong a little bit for me is that this kid was struggling in AAA. He didn't deserve to get the call based on performance. He struggled last year. And the Miami Marlins have a somewhat competent offense is the way I would describe it. And he was great. Like, he was dominant in a lot of ways. So I know that these are always tough, and I always get emails from people saying, just don't pick one. Don't pick an I'm the man right now. I'm sorry. I've got OCD. We're picking an I'm the man right now. And I do think it's Jonah Tong. So it's one of those cases where when you get swept, it's difficult. Looking back at this season, they got swept four times this year. Your I'm the man right now is during the sweep. The Colorado sweep, Carson Bench. The Chicago sweep, MJ Melendez. The Dodgers sweep, Nolan McClain. The A's sweep, Freddie Peralta. So there's always a way. So I'll go with Jonah Tong as the man right now. Where things get difficult and contentious is the net negative, because there are so many options. One guy I'm going to exclude right away is Devin Williams. Just lay off Devin Williams. Devin Williams, while he sucked on Sunday, I'm not defending that performance. He has been so good recently. And the Met offense scored zero runs in nine innings. Like, we can mention him because he didn't pitch well Sunday, but it ain't him. You know, when you have a three-game series against the Marlins and score two runs on 11 hits over the course of the three games, it's someone on offense. So I'm going to quickly give you some numbers, and then you tell me what jumps out at you, because I now can hear Pete, so that's good. Carson Bench was 0-for-11 in this series. 0-for-11. With five strikeouts. Bo Bichette was 1-for-12 in this series. We mentioned Soto was okay. Vientos 2-for-10 with an RBI. Beatty 1-for-7. Marcus Semien 0-for-10. Luis Torrens 0-for-5. So you're looking at Simeon's 0-for-10, Bichette's 1-for-12, and Benge is 0 for 11 as the numbers that really jump out at you. If you want to give one of them a net negative, who jumps out at you without even hearing those numbers? Just watching these three games is the ultimate net negative.
I think Benge had a really bad series. I mean, offensively, yes, but I don't. Jesus Christ. I don't think his defense was good either, Benge.
Did you say Benge?
Yes, I did.
I'm not against giving it to Benge. I feel like this is one of those spots where there's a part of us, part of me maybe, that doesn't want to give it to a young player, that there's a bias against Simeon and Bichette because of the expectations and the salaries. But you're not wrong about Carson Benge. What defensive play jumps out at you? I'm trying to separate individual games because obviously he's had his trouble defensively, but was there anything in this series that was that bad from Carson Benge?
I felt on Friday he just was misplaying balls in right field all game. Like, I mean, it was all down the line. He just wasn't making catches. He wasn't getting to spots where I think he would have normally gotten to. Maybe there was nothing like that was egregious, but it just seemed like he wasn't getting there.
Maybe the triple to Esturi Ruiz, that was that fly ball down the right field line that it felt like the ball was in the air for so long, and then he got there and it dropped in for a triple, which turned out to be the game-winning run. So I guess that would be the one, maybe.
Yeah, I feel like it wasn't a clean series for him defensively. Offensively, he did nothing. I mean, he stole a base today, yippity kaye, but I mean, that's nothing, dude.
The reason I'm going to lean towards Simeon over Benge, because look, they both didn't do enough. Your leadoff hitter goes 0 for 11. It ain't good enough. I mean, it's just the bottom line. Like, it was an awful, awful series. Benge in the opener ran into the awful luck. Remember, the first at-bat he took in this series was the ball
that
Marcy made the great play on, and then two innings later, he did the same thing. So with Benge, there's a little bit of bad luck, two bad locks that could have been extra base hits. Marcus Simeon feels like a rally killer. He just feels like the guy who comes up, and the Mets rarely have rallies, and it goes nowhere. Friday night, he never came up with guys on base. On Saturday, he comes up with a runner on first, one out in the second inning, and bounces into a double play. He comes up in the seventh inning with a runner on first, two outs, and he grounds out. On Sunday, he's the one who hit the ground ball that turned into the two-base error. He didn't do anything good. Sixth inning, comes on, leadoff man on, bounces into a double play. So multiple double plays, multiple rallies killed. I think it's Marcus Simeon as the net negative. I know you can't argue with that because it's basically like they all suck, so it's easy to pick somebody. But I would give Simeon the slight edge on Benge based on the rally-killing nature of some of his at-bats and the fact that Benge did actually hit into some genuine bad luck, especially on Friday night.
By the way, did you see the, I believe it was Dom Smith highlight that they mirrored back-to-back with Benge? And it wasn't Marcy playing center field, and it turned into a Dom Smith inside the park home run. And Carson Benge hit it basically in the same spot, and Marcy just is a better outfielder and tracked it down. So you're right. That was just miserable. It's just bad luck. But again, the Mets continuously have bad luck. Eventually, things are going to have to change, right?
Well, no. I think when you so rarely hit, the bad luck is more obvious. Like, if you have a good offense, you hit in a bad luck too, but then the next batter rips a double anyway. When you have an offense that is as bad as the Mets, your bad luck gets exposed even more because it's one of the rare opportunities you actually have to score. And so that's where I think the bad luck is. But congratulations to Marcus Simeon. You are now a three-time award winner of the net negative. So here are your standings for the net negatives in a net negative season. Bo Bichette has won it five times. Marcus Simeon has won it three times. And the only other person that's won it multiple times is Francisco Lindor, who won it in back-to-back weeks much earlier in the season when he wasn't hurt. So that's the state of the Mets. And you could tell how the offseason's gone when Bo Bichette and Marcus Simeon is just absolutely cleaning up the net negative award. And meanwhile, Bo Bichette recently won the Rico. I'm the Man right now. Marcus Semien has not won it yet this season. So you've got a combined 8 net negatives from those two guys and a combined 1 I'm the Man right now from those guys, perfectly exemplifying the garbage seasons of both players.
So if you had to compare right now, you'd say that the financial, the salaries, the budget this year, it's highly more into the negative than the positive. The net negative is more expensive than what the I'm the Man right now costs.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. By a little bit. By a little bit. So is the season over is always the question. Yes, it certainly feels that way. But that's not going to stop a lot of us from going to Citi Field on Monday on a beautiful, and I don't even know if it's going to be beautiful, Memorial Day afternoon. I think Monday's game, and you look ahead to this series, and I'm not even going to give you this, oh, they got to go win 7 in a row because that feels unrealistic, or they got to go win 4 out of 6 or 5 out of 6. Look, this team right now just needs to play better baseball. Even when they were winning, they weren't playing better baseball. I think what's really important on Monday is Nolan McClain. Nolan McClain is one of the reasons that we have a level of confidence in this team, or at least the future of this team, or one of the things we're excited about with this team. And he's coming off of the worst start of his major league career. And one of those losses that you'll remember. It's not all on him. Yes, if a play is made here or there, it could look very differently. But the Mets were about to have a 4-game winning streak, which they haven't had this season. They were about to have a 4-game winning streak. They had a 5-0 lead. They had Nolan McClain on the mound, and they blew it going away. So I really want to see a bounce back from him. And not that this should make anybody feel better. They're facing Nick Lodolo, who's only made 3 starts this year and has not pitched well. He's pitched to a 7.20 ERA. Not that that means anything. That usually means 6 1/3 innings, no runs. That's usually the formula when you face guys who are struggling. But I look at Monday's game, the opener of this series, as a real opportunity for Nolan McClain. After that, I think it's going to be, I'm trying to think how they're going to map this out now. I guess it would be the David Peterson game, and it's a matter of how they use him. And then Jonah Tong, I guess, would be on the mound. That's probably how they're going to line up this Cincinnati series. I'm excited to see Jonah Tong. He pitched really well on Friday, and there is a part of me that thinks that maybe the Mets should go and continue with the opener with Peterson and Tong. It's not that big of a deal to do it. You're just using a relief pitcher at the beginning of a game, but because Peterson has fared better in that regard, despite his last start, which he pitched well as a regular starter, I think it was the lineup that made more sense for him. Maybe that helps Jonah Tong too. Maybe. I'm not against it. And they'll have to make a decision real soon on A.J. Minter and him coming back. Obviously, Craig Kimbrell was finally DFA'd, which I think was inevitable. Craig Kimbrell was up here. He was not awful, but he certainly wasn't good. He was an old, washed-up pitcher who every once in a while would pitch okay. But the way they used him in his last performance, when they pushed him through parts of 3 innings, you kind of knew it was probably the end of Craig Kimbrell. But you look at this bullpen right now and you say, all right, who's the one that goes down? Jonathan Pintaro actually looked pretty good in his 1 appearance. So he would logically be the guy that goes down for an A.J. Minter upon his return. And then you also ask yourself, how long of a leash does Jonah Tong get? Jonah Tong pitched really well on Friday. He earned another opportunity. But if he comes out on Tuesday or Wednesday and really struggles, does that mean he goes back to AAA? Because the kid they called up in Thornton was not terrible, and now he's back in AAA for 10 days. So I'm very curious to see how David Stearns and this front office kind of handle the young pitchers in terms of who gets opportunities and when. And I think where this season is going and how bad they are, back to 9 games under .500, does that mean that it's not worth ever having Sean Manaea enter the rotation? Because you are getting a look at the future. But keep this in mind about Manaea. He's got another year left on his deal, and he's making $25 million. So as much as you want to see Tong, and you want to see Thornton, and you want to see the future, Sean Manaea is, for now, a part of the future. Also, keep an eye on Kodai Senga. He made his first rehab start. They've got a 30-day window to check Kodai Senga out. His first start at single A was bad. What does that mean? It means if he doesn't pitch well in his rehab starts in the minor leagues, there is no way in hell they could call him up and re-enter him into the rotation. If Kodai Senga can be impressive, if he can pitch well down there, kind of the same thing with Manaea. He's under contract. Not for this year, but for next year. So not that you want them to pitch well because you're going to have them in your 2027 plans, but dare I say they pitch well and you could trade them. Now, I don't think either guy's going to have much trade value, especially because of their contracts. But I think if Senga can pitch well in his rehab starts, I would want to see him in this rotation. What I learned from him in the rotation may not be much, but I wouldn't just move him into the bullpen in some kind of non-existent role. That's for sure. So keep an eye on that. But the Mets begin a 6-game homestand. Yippee. Are we excited? Are we pumped up? Just give us competent baseball. Just give us this offense doing something. These last 3 games were pathetic, and hopefully it gets better. But I'm not confident. We appreciate you listening and downloading the Rico Bronya. If you're a new listener, we remind you to subscribe. Make sure you never miss an edition. We always give you Rico Bronyas at the conclusion of each series, like we're doing right now. And then we pretty consistently give you pop-up Ricos throughout the season. Sometimes it's based on the game and what happened. Sometimes it's based on just me saying I'm in the mood to do a Rico Bronya. Sometimes it works that way. So make sure you're subscribed to the Rico wherever you download your podcast and you'll never miss an episode. Or you could subscribe to the WFAN YouTube page and you won't miss an episode there as well. Hang in there. Look at it this way. We're going to be with you all season long. As bad as this team gets, unlike this lineup, we don't tap out. So we will be here. Thank you very much for listening to another depressing edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.